would and confess their sins and the iniquities of their fathers. That's how the book of Nehemiah, chapter 9, begins. And Nehemiah 9 is in the middle, of course, of the book of Nehemiah, which occurs after the people have returned from exile. The people of Israel were so wicked, they were so bent on idolatry and sin, they had refused so frequently and so often to just do what God said, to even feel sorry about what they'd done, to repent, that God had said, listen, I've had enough of this. I'm driving you out of the land, and you will be exiles in Babylon. And they were exiles in Babylon for 70 years, until God, as he has done so frequently, as we've seen in the book of Judges, we've seen in the book of Samuel, as we've seen throughout every period of stage of human history, that when they cried out to him, God repented of his own anger, and he brought them back to the land. But when they got back to the land, everything wasn't rosy. Nothing looked so good. That the amazing kingdom that they thought would come, the amazing kingdom that they had been told and planned and listened to the prophets to know was coming, it didn't look like what they saw. Instead, they returned and they had a lot of work to do. That instead of having a kingdom with a king, they had, at most, a city. And they didn't even really have that city. That if we read the numbers of exiles that return, the number of people who returns is pitifully small. They're pitifully weak. That instead of having the whole country, even of Israel, as we would think about it, that instead of having this, that it had been chopped up and given, and you have Samaritans in the north who are in control, and they're causing problems for you, that they have a lot of work to do. And so Nehemiah, who's one of the king's advisors, decides that he's going to come back and help them. And he finds that he, when he returns, has a lot of work to do. This is actually a sermon that I preached a few weeks back for a group that they had in at Lute. But it's one of the few sermons I've liked enough to preach again. And I figured, hey, if I think it's worth hearing me studying again and looking again, I thought hopefully y'all would appreciate hearing it once. I almost never re-preach sermons, but I said, hey, this one's actually hopefully decent. And I hope that you agree after hearing it that it was worth hearing once. But if we think about what goes on then when we get to Nehemiah chapter 9, there's this really complex situation about what's going on and how to resolve it. And we see that it begins then in chapter 9, verses 1 and 2, that it begins on the 24th day of the month, and the people of Israel were all assembled with fasting, and they were in sackcloth and ashes with earth on their heads, and the Israelites had separated themselves from the foreigners. And they stood, and they confessed their sins and the iniquities of their fathers. That they realize what is going on. But Nehemiah chapter 9, when it opens up, it's a scene that is dramatically different from what we'd seen if we'd looked before in chapter 8. The chapter 8 is filled with joy. In chapter 8 of Nehemiah, Ezra reads the law, and at first the people are stricken because they realize all the wickedness they had done and all of the laws that they were breaking, and they understood what their punishment should be. And yet Nehemiah and the priest tell them, no, 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 no. This day is holy to the Lord your God. Don't mourn and don't weep. And instead of weeping and instead of mourning, they proclaim a feast throughout the entire land. And as he says in chapter 8, verses 9 and 10, because the joy of the Lord is your true strength. Then in chapter 8, their mourning is turned to joy. And the people carry on in this feast. They go on from the water gate. They're eating, they're drinking, they're sending gifts to people who weren't there. And all of this was because, as we see in chapter 8, verse 12, they understood the words which had been made known to them. That they understood not just their sin, but God's mercy. And immediately after this, it says on the second day in chapter 8, verse 13, they celebrate then the Feast of Booths, which celebrates, of course, the harvest, but not just the harvest, but more importantly, their liberation from bondage in Egypt. Leviticus chapter 23, verses 42 and 43 says, listen, when you get to the land, you're going to celebrate this Feast of Booths because you're going to remember that you were sojourners and strangers in Egypt. You're going to remember that you didn't dwell in houses that were really yours. And you need to remember that you are strangers even in your own land. That this, as David's talked about in 1 Peter in his really good class this morning, is something that is prevalent throughout the entire Old Testament and is true for us today. That even when they were landed, even when they had their home, even when they thought that's where they were supposed to be, they were supposed to remember when you weren't. Act as though you are still an exile. But it has, when they celebrate the Feast of Booths this year, has something a little bit different, because although it commemorated their bondage and slavery as being exiles in Egypt, that them having just come out of bondage and slavery from Babylon would hold a new meaning, where God has brought a second exodus, saving them and bringing them back to the land. And so by the time we get to Nehemiah chapter 9, verses 1 and 2, on the 24th day of a month, they have had a bit of whiplash going back and forth between feasting and famine. Because it says this is the 24th day of the 7th month. Now, most of us probably read past that, or we think, okay, this is a period, just kind of an example of chronological exactitude. You know, Nehemiah just wants to be exact, so we know exactly what it is, so we can build our calendar and understand kind of the timeline. But there's something more going on there that if we, which this is probably all of us, me included a lot of the times, that we don't have their calendar in the middle of our head. Now, if I said, hey, on July 5th, okay, then you're automatically thinking, okay, day after Independence Day, right? Day after this, it might be involved in something. And that's exactly what happens here. See, the seventh month in the Jewish calendar is filled with really important events. If we think about it, the first day of the seventh month is the Jewish New Year. This is the feast to which all adult males were required to show up in Jerusalem. One of the few times that they were all required to show up to Jerusalem. And this is then the scene of Ezra reading the law. And he read the law because everybody was there to hear it. But then on the 10th day of the month, that's the Day of Atonement. And the Day of Atonement, of course, is the only annual fast that the people had to participate in. If we looked in Leviticus chapter 16, we'd read all about the Day of Atonement. That we would read about that here they would have to offer sacrifices for every single person. But they didn't just offer sacrifices for every person. They also had to offer sacrifices for the nation as a whole. And for the leadership individually. And they even had to offer sacrifices for the altar and the tabernacle and the implements of the altar. Because on the Day of Atonement, what the people realized is that sin contaminates. And it doesn't just contaminate me and contaminate you. It doesn't just contaminate those of us who have choices and decisions. It doesn't just contaminate those of us who are free moral agents. That if we take seriously the Day of Atonement, sin contaminates everything. Even the inanimate objects of altar and land. That our sin is so dangerous that everything we touch catches it. And so on the Day of Atonement, they don't just offer sacrifices for their sins, but to cleanse those things which were affected by their sins. And then on the 15th through the 22nd day of the month, you have a week-long feast, which is the Feast of Booths that we just talked about, that's celebrating their liberation from Egypt. And so they go from feast on the day, on the New Year, to fast on the Day of Atonement, to a week of feasting in the for the Feast of Booths. And then 2 days later, here we have, because the Sukkot, or the Feast of Booths, ends on the 22nd, here it is on the 24th again, and they're back to fasting. They have whiplash. That their transition from feast to fast, though, is really important for us to take into consideration. Because think about this. It's easy to take time off of work if you're going to go and have fun. That in this situation, right, that they would be leaving their farms for a week. Now, it's bad enough for those of us who, you know, may or may not get paid time off to take a week off of work when we're, you know, needing to do that. But here, this is the time of harvest where they would have been pulled away from their fields at the most crucial time for providing this harvest. But at least they're going and they're having a good time. They're having a feast. They're getting together with everybody. But now you're at the end of that week and you're thinking, I need to get back my farm. I need to get back to work. I've got things to do. I don't want my grain rotting in the field. But the people stay in Jerusalem. And they don't just stay. This isn't the next morning afterwards where we're thinking, okay, they're going to finish the 22nd. We're going to get started early in the morning of the 23rd, right? Get back to home. That they are still in Jerusalem on the 24th for this to happen. And that's because something has happened to them. That if we remember in Nehemiah chapter 8, as they're having these feasts, they're not just having feasts. That the Levites are going through and they're reading the entire law. And paragraph by paragraph, the Levites explain what this means. That they're having long, basically, Bible classes. And the people have realized after this Feast of Booths that, you know what? Something else needs to occur. That their feast has left more in them than just a sweet taste in their mouths. That they realize they are in big trouble because they've read the law and they know what they are not doing. And so they gather together all of the people and they separate themselves from the foreigners because, you know, as we're about to see what they're going to do, that they don't have necessarily, they don't want to be lumped in with us here. And they mourn and they fast again and they put sackcloth on and they put earth on their heads. And we remember what we talked about in Samuel, that this whole earth on their heads is symbolizing the fact that they are as though they are dead, as though they are already under the dirt, as though they are already in their graves, that they recognize the seriousness of their problem, and they get together and they confessed, it says, all of the sins of their fathers. And verses 3 and 4 says, and they stood up in their place, and they read from the book of the law of the Lord for 3 hours. And for another 3 hours, they made confession. And they worshiped the Lord their God. And on the stairs of the Levites stood all these guys until finally they stood up. And they said, stand up and bless the Lord your God from everlasting to everlasting. Blessed be your glorious name, which is exalted above all peoples and all praise. So after getting together and joining together, then mourning and putting themselves in this position, they read from the law for 3 hours. And we can probably assume that this is kind of like the same reading that they did in Ezra chapter 8, where they're going through paragraph by paragraph and the Levites are explaining what they read, that this is basically, you know, the first Bible class that we would read about, right? You know, it says the Levites read and then explain what it meant. But here they do this for 3 hours, and I promise my sermon will be shorter than that. If we don't get rained out, right? But after reading, they spend another 3 hours confessing. That they read, as Paul tells Timothy in 1 Timothy chapter 4, verse 13, publicly. That this is a sustained communal interaction, and that everybody there are people who are Israelites, of people who understand what this means to them. And after being there for 3 hours, that this drives them to something. This isn't just intellectual knowledge, right? That they're not just reading and saying, okay, that's nice, we're going home now. That after 3 hours of reading and studying, they realize something needs to be done. And so they spend another 3 hours in confessing. And then if we read any of the great confessional prayers in the Bible, if you ever have a hard time remembering, it's really nice. They're always in chapter 9. So there's Ezra chapter 9, Daniel chapter 9, Nehemiah chapter 9. Basically, pick a book in the exile, read chapter 9, and it's going to be a confessory prayer. But always it begins by recounting and understanding something about their history. And so they begin to confess. And where they begin is with God's blessings for them. Know what it says, starting in verse 6, then going through verse 15. You are the Lord, and you alone. You've made heaven, the heaven of heavens with all of its host. And you made earth and all that is in it, and you made the seas and all that is within, and you preserve everything. The host of heaven worships you. You are the Lord, the God who chose Abram and brought him out of Ur of the Chaldeans and gave him the name Abraham. And you found his heart faithful before you. And you made with him a covenant to give his offspring of the land of the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Perizzite, the Jebusite, the Girgashite. And you kept your promise because you are righteous. And then you saw the affliction of our fathers in Egypt and heard their cry at the Red Sea. And you performed signs and wonders against Pharaoh and all of his servants and all the people of his land because you knew that they acted arrogantly against our fathers. And you made a name for yourself, as it is to this day. And you divided the sea before them so that they walked through in the midst of dry land. And you cast their pursuers into the depths, just like a stone into mighty waters. By a pillar of cloud you led them in the day, and by a pillar of fire at night to light them on the way before them, when the way they should go. And you came down on Mount Sinai and spoke with them from heavens, and you gave them right rules and true laws and good statutes and good commandments. And you made known to them your holy Sabbath and commanded them commandments and statutes, a law by Moses your servant. And you gave them bread from heaven for their hunger. And you brought for them water out of a rock for their thirst. And you told them to go into the land and to possess what you had sworn to give them. If we think about this section, that it begins by really telling the story from creation to Sinai. And it's a confession in both senses of that word. If we think about confession, a lot of times we think about the confessing where you confess something bad that you've done to someone else. But confess means something else as well. To confess, in this case, means to tell of the greatness of God. That we confess who God is, and that their confession, before they can say the things they've done wrong, they begin with who God is and His glory and confessing what He has done right. And you probably noticed, I emphasized it to help us kind of focus on a little bit, but how often did we hear the word "you"? That the focus here is entirely on God and what God has done. That we have the word "you gave" 14 different times in this one section. It's the greatest, from what I can tell, the greatest concentration of this word in a single text anywhere in the Bible. That this focuses entirely on God's goodness and entirely on God's grace. That if we think about what they've done twice in the past month, that they've spent significant time reading the Bible, reading, we would think, the Torah, reading the first five books of Moses. What have they read about? But God's creation. About God saving them from Egypt, about the patriarchs, all these things. And they have internalized those lessons. Because in this prayer, we see what? The story of God. Bringing His people to Him. And the story of God who has done everything for His people. Think about all the blessings that it talks about that God has done. God created the world. God chose Abraham. God made a covenant with them. God rescued Abraham's descendants from Egypt. God sustained them in the wilderness. God gave them the law. God gave them the Sabbath. God gave them the land. You know what's missing in all of that? Israel. There's virtually no mention of Israel. That this is entirely a one-sided pronouncement. That Israel isn't there. And if we think about how this would interact, that if we think that they know the stories, which they would have done, that this would have been something that would have had that blank space, that haunting silence. Because yes, okay, we talked about God creating the world. But you know what's not mentioned? Adam and Eve messing it all up. Yeah, we talked about choosing Abraham. Because of his faith. But you know what's not mentioned? All the mistakes that Abraham made. Like saying, "Oh, well, she's my sister," twice. Or leaving the land when he's not supposed to. Yeah, it talks about God making the covenant with the people to give them the land. But you know what it doesn't talk about? The people refusing to honor that covenant. That it talks about God bringing them out of Egypt and sustaining them in the wilderness. But you know what it doesn't talk about? How many times the people did not want that and refused to follow him. It talks about him giving the law, but it doesn't talk about the fact that, you know what they were doing when God was giving Moses the law at Sinai? Making a golden calf. The focus here is on God. That they confess who God is and what his character is like. And that's because they realize something that I think is crucial. The reason we follow God isn't just because we know what he wants us to do. It's because we know who he is. That our hope is based in God's character, not in his rules. And before we can confess what we have done, we must confess who he is. But if you're thinking, well, we got to get to the other part of confession, don't worry, that's coming up next. In other words, if we might say, okay, we haven't focused on the Israelites' stiff-necked and stubbornness, the answer would be, yet. Yet. And as we go from creation to Sinai here, then in this passage, then what we understand is that God's blessings are throughout. Whereas the next section then is going to be a little bit more even, that we're going to see that God is going to continue to bless his people in spite of their frequent rebellion. And read if you want these verses with me in 16 through 25, but they... And you always love, right? This is the first but we've gotten in the text. Have you ever heard, you know, when you're talking to someone else and you say, you know, you've done this, and you've done that, and then there's this hanging but, right? You all know what it's coming. It's just there in the back of your mind. And certainly this but would be the same thing that was in the back of their minds when they were reading through all these texts, right? Like, but this. And so here we start out then, but they, our fathers, acted presumptuously. And they stiffened their necks, and they did not obey your commandments. They refused to obey, and they were not mindful of the wonders that you performed among them. And so they stiffened their neck, and they appointed a leader to return them to slavery in Egypt. But you are a God who is ready to forgive. You are gracious and merciful, slow to anger, and abounding in covenantal faithfulness, and you did not forsake them. Even when they'd made themselves a golden calf and said, "This is your God who brought you out of Egypt." And even when they'd committed great blasphemies, you in your great mercies did not forsake them in the wilderness. The pillar of cloud to lead them on the way did not depart from them by day, nor did the pillar of fire by night for light for them by the way which they should go. Instead, you gave them your good spirit to instruct them. And you never withheld your manna from their mouth or from giving them water for their thirst. For 40 years you sustained them in the wilderness, and they lacked nothing. Their clothing didn't wear out, their feet didn't swell. And you gave them kingdoms and peoples and allotted to them every corner. So they took possession of the land of Sihon, the king of Heshbon, and the land of Og, the king of Bashan, and you multiplied their children as many as the stars of heaven. And you brought them into the land which they had told their fathers to enter and possess. So the descendants went in, and they possessed the land, and you subdued before them the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, and you gave them into your hand with their kings and their peoples of the land, that they might do as they would. And they captured fortified cities and a rich land, and they took possession of houses full of good things, cisterns already hewn, vineyards already planted, and fruit trees in abundance. And they ate, and they were filled, and they became fat, and they delighted themselves in your great goodness. But as we continue first then from creation to Sinai, that here then we have from Sinai to conquest. And really, like as I've said before, the focus then is on how great God's blessings were in spite of the constant rebellions of the people. That here, instead of focusing entirely on God, we're kind of going back and forth, that it balances God's actions with man's reactions. Except, of course, that these are not reactions, because as we read about the abounding sin of the people, time and time again, we are met with nothing but the superabundance of God's grace. That even when Israel opts back to turn to Egypt to elect a new leader and a new God, God stands by his people. God keeps his promises. He provides their needs and their desires. He gives them food, water, hope, and instruction. Although the people lacked for nothing, they appreciated nothing. I think this is really impressive. In one of the songs that David led, in the Faith That Will Not Shrink, I really love verse 2 as we compare it to how this works. Verse 1 is, "Oh, for a faith that will not shrink, though pressed by every foe, that will not tremble on the brink of any earthly woe, that will not murmur or complain beneath the chastening rod." Anytime you read murmuring and complaining, whether it's in a song or anything else, of course it's referencing the time in the wilderness. But think about the comparison here, that we're requesting a faith that will not murmur or complain beneath the chastening rod. But here the people of Israel, they murmured and complained even though they had everything. You want food? You have food. Oh, you don't want to have to like make it? Fine, it's ready made for you. Oh, you need water? Here's water. You want meat? Here's meat. Oh, by the way, the food tastes amazing. And your clothes never wear out. Your shoes never wear out. Everything is perfect for you all the time. But what did the people do? Murmur and complain over and over again. That as we read about in the first section, that even the hosts of heaven worship God, that here, although God makes his people as numerous as the hosts of heaven, you know what they don't do? Worship God. That they are an antithesis of this creation that he has done. That we who should be the crown of God's creation are instead decreating what he has done through our sin. And so it ends then there, that verse on them taking the land and taking, of course, the cisterns they didn't dig, the vineyards that they've not planted. And this, as we've talked about before, is an image that that every time this shows up is talking about the comparisons between God's giving them a gift and them refusing it. That in Deuteronomy chapter 6, verses 10 through 11, it says, when God brings you into the land and gives you vineyards you didn't plant and cisterns you didn't dwell and you live in houses you didn't build, that you remember your God and don't get the hot head. Because if you get the high handedness and think this is because of somehow great we were, then God's going to take you out of that land. That in Joshua chapter 24, verse 13, you know, the great chapter that everybody knows, as for me and for my house, we will serve the Lord. That when you actually, and we think, oh, this is so good that, you know, Joshua's standing up for the Levites and for the Israelites, and they're all going to be that good. That when you read it again a little closer, you're actually realizing that Joshua's whole point is that, I know you guys don't serve the Lord, but as for me and for my house, we will. And then he tells them in verse 13, speaking for God, I gave you a land which you did not toil and cities you did not build, and you live in them and eat from vineyards and olive groves that you did not plant. And the point here is that you choose which God you're going to serve, because if you don't, then I'm going to bring you out from them. Or in Zephaniah chapter 1, although they build houses, they will not inhabit them. Though they plant vineyards, you will not drink wine from them. And that's because God says, I'm going to take you out of the land. And here, in Nehemiah, having just come back in, they've seen, of course, that God's commands were exactly that. That they were taken out of the land, just as Deuteronomy had said, just as Moses had said. And as they have just probably finished reading through the Torah, finished reading through the Pentateuch, finished reading through Genesis, through Deuteronomy, what do they have in the back of their mind? But of course, God's promises in Deuteronomy that if you don't do what I'm telling you to do, then I will take you out of the land and into exile. They have come back from the land and they understand what happened. They say, God, we did it. And you were right to do what you have done. But then what we see here is that whereas they have continued on there in God's rebellion, God has continued to bless them in spite of rebellion, that now they're going to continue to rebel in spite of God's blessings. That it says then, nevertheless, they were disobedient and they rebelled against you, and they cast your law behind their backs, and they killed your prophets who had warned them in order to turn them back to you. And they committed great blasphemies. And so, therefore, you gave them into the hand of their enemies who made them suffer. And at the time of their suffering, they cried out to you, and you heard them from heaven according to your great mercies, and you gave them saviors who saved them from the hand of their enemies. But after they had rest, they again did what was evil before you, and you abandoned them to the hand of their enemies so that they would have dominion over them. And yet when they turned and when they cried to you, you heard them still from heaven. And many times you delivered them according to your mercies. And you warned them so they wouldn't turn back to your law. Yet they acted presumptuously again. They did not obey your commandments. They sinned against your rules, which is a person would just do them. He would live by them. And they turned a stubborn shoulder and they stiffened their neck and they would not obey. And for many years you stuck with them and you warned them by your spirit through the prophets, but they wouldn't give an ear. Therefore you gave them in the hand of the people of the lands, and nevertheless, in your great mercies, you did not make an end of them, and you did not forsake them, because you are a gracious and merciful God. That if we think about the last period, you know, that starts out in divine blessings, right? That it's from creation to Sinai, and then we go from Sinai to the land and to the conquest, and then we have here that we know what comes after Joshua, right? It's the book of Judges. And this is exactly what this recounts. But you know what's pretty amazing? Is that in how this tells the story of Judges, it doesn't mention their names or events. It doesn't say Gideon or Samson or Jephthah or Deborah or Barak. You know what it does instead? It tells us the cycle of the judges. That it tells us that this is what has happened. That we have the same steady de-evolution of sin, decline, appeal, rescue, and sin that I talk about in your bulletin today. That this is, to my knowledge, the earliest commentary on the book of Judges that tells us exactly how we, a lot of us, David was teaching it and how I taught it, is that you have this spiral of sin and how it works in their actions. That this is, we see the Nehemiah and the Levites who are saying this confession recognize this is exactly what's happening. That however many times they sinned, when they cried out to you, God, you would send a Savior to help them, but then they would just sin again and again and again and again. And whereas God has given them into the peoples of the land, that they take hope, that say, nevertheless, in your great compassion, you didn't forsake them because you were gracious and compassionate. That in the cycle of the judges of God handing them over into the power of foreign enemies, they see, of course, the ultimate example of what's happened to them. That they too have been handed over into foreign enemies, that they have been handed over to Babylon. But God did not forsake them there, but God brought them back. And they end then in an appeal to deliverance. Now therefore, O God, the great, the mighty, and the awesome God who keeps his covenant with steadfast love, don't let our hardship seem so little to you that's come upon us, upon our kings, upon our princes, upon our priests, our prophets, our fathers, and all your people, since the time of the king of Assyria until this day. Now, don't get us wrong. You have been righteous in everything that's happened to us, because you have dealt faithfully and we have dealt wickedly. Our kings, our princes, our priests, our fathers, none of them kept the law. None of them paid attention to your commandments nor the warnings that you gave them. Even in our own kingdom and amidst your great goodness that you gave them, in the large and wicked land you have set before them, they didn't serve you. They didn't turn from their wicked works. Behold, we are slaves this day in the land that you gave to our fathers to enjoy its fruit and its good gifts. Behold, we are slaves. And its rich yield goes to the kings whom you have set over us because of our sins, and they rule our bodies and over our livestock just as they please, and we are in great distress. We are in great distress. If we think about Nehemiah 9, and if we think about confession, then I think that we have to realize, first of all, that confession teaches. And first of all, just as it does here, that it teaches about God. The confession isn't just about wallowing in self-doubt or self-reproach. It isn't just about saying how terrible you are. It isn't just a recounting of the list of bad things that you've done. Instead, true confession teaches who God is. That it seeks to validate God rather than to validate ourselves. That time and time again we have the statement that God, no, you're righteous. Now here they are in the midst of their suffering saying, God, don't think our suffering is light. Don't think it's easy for us. But let's keep the front thing in the front of our minds, and that is you are righteous and that we deserve this. And so let's talk about who you are and what you've done. And that's where this prayer begins. But it doesn't just teach about God. It also teaches us about ourselves. And if at first, if we think about this, it kind of flies in the face, at least what, I don't know about you, but what I've heard a lot of times when people are discussing, you know, how specific should prayers be and things of that nature. I mean, if we think about it this way, that, you know, if what in this prayer did God not already know? And the answer, of course, is nothing, right? And so we might ask ourselves, hey, what's the point in rehearsing before God the all too well known failures of our past and the failures of Israel's apostasy? And I think the reason why it's important is that there are two ways to read Israel's story. The first, of course, is a history of apostasy. It's a history of sin, a history of failure. But there's another way to read Israel's history as well. And that is as a history of God's salvation and God's power and God's love and God's desire to bring us back, that it's not just a reminder of failure, but a reminder of God's success. And that there is a point in having the whole congregation pray together and confess and say, this is who we are, but this is who God is. That this prayer is teaching them, that it is self-reflective, that it is critical, and that it understands the demands of God's grace. And if we think about it, the Levites who speak these sins and the people who confess these sins, none of them personally were involved in any of the sins they talked about. They weren't the ones who grumbled and complained in the wilderness. They're not the ones who built the golden calf. They're not the ones who, as it says, our fathers and our priests and the Levites and the kings and the princes and everybody else sinned. That they don't have a problem with idolatry now. And yet, they understand because just recently they've had the Day of Atonement that sin is contagious. And the sin influences everything, that it affects the land and it affects us, that we are all inheritors, not of Adam and Eve's guilt, but of the consequences of their sin, that we live in a broken world that yearns for recreation and renewal. And that they would have understood that. And they understand that they are inheritors of those issues. But confession doesn't just teach. And this is, I think, the key point. Confession hopes. This confession isn't just right about teaching. That after they go through this whole laundry list of God's greatnesses and their own wickedness, that it ends with a practical motive, that it is an appeal to God's character that he should once again deliver Israel from their overlords and restore the promised land to them. In other words, this is a hope which is rooted in history. And it's an appeal to God for whom his character is. Because the end of this prayer really summarizes what Israel is like at the end of the Old Testament. Think about it. God has brought them back to the land, and that's true. But the land isn't theirs. The land is Persia's. They make that abundantly clear here. Sure, we're in the land, but we don't rule it. And you know who we had to keep on paying tribute and taxes and all of our good stuff is going to? It's going to Persia. And God, that's not what you promised us would happen. That when we read about the prophets and we read about your promises, that's not what you said was going to happen, God. And we're not okay with that. And this isn't just complaining. This is petition. That they are prisoners and underlings to a foreign overlord who is not the Lord. There is still so much left to hope for. There is still so much left that they desire. There is still so much more left that God has promised them. And they know this isn't it. That's how the Old Testament ends, really. The God has been faithful, but he hasn't fulfilled his promises. God keeps his promises, but he hasn't yet. That there is something better, something new coming for us. And we long for it, and we pray for it, and we yearn for its completion. They, of course, are looking forward to the promises of the real kingdom, of Jesus. And those, although that's the way the Old Testament ends, in some ways, it's the way that our New Testament ends as well. That we have the church, and it is a wonderful, great, amazing blessing. That we have God's promises, that we have forgiveness, that we have prayer, that we have the Spirit. But God's promises are not yet completely fulfilled. Because this, as good as the church is, isn't the fullness of what he's promised us. That we still long for a land that is truly ours, which is in heaven, that we long for the completion of his promises. And as we look in our lives, as we confess who God is and we confess who we are and what we have done, we do so always hoping for the completion of his promises. As David talked about in his class, the future of salvation with Christ our Lord, where we will inherit something far better than what we have today.